out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 9th of July, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Normally on a Monday, I am here on my own, but I am very pleased to welcome back to the show today, Eddie Morrison, for some more of 50 years of British nationalism. Eddie, how are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. Failing me 50 years of British nationalism, but pleased to be here, Sven.
Well, hopefully it'll be a bit easier for you doing it on a Monday rather than on a Wednesday.
Yes. I mean, with my extremely busy schedule organising World Revolution, I have to fit in the night of days when I can. But Monday's quite good.
Excellent.
And today, before the CAA jump on me, I'm not really organising a world revolution.
Just had to add that disclaimer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, today, what we're going to go into today is back in the 50s and the 60s, there was an organisation called the League of Empire Loyalists.
Correct.
And that was started by A.K. Chesterton. Now, I don't know whether I'm correct in my memory on this or not. When I was a child, I'm sure I can remember watching a film. I think it was a Carry On film, and it had the League of Empire Loyalists in it, and they were performing some kind of stunt. And it uh-huh. was either at the end of the film or the film was based around it. And I think that shows you that, this organization was quite mainstream. They had a lot of support, and it was in one of these old British films, but I can't remember what it is. You can't remember what it is. Maybe some of the listeners do. Maybe one of the listeners knows which film this is and tell me that I'm not going mad. It's not just a fantasy I have of the League of Empire Loyalists. But, they were pretty big, and they were something to do with the Conservative Party, I believe, as well.
Very, very much so. I mean, A.K. Chesterton, the founder, as some people may be aware, but going back into the 30s, A.K., I'm pleased to say I actually knew quite well when we formed the NEP. Chesterton, very, very bright bloke. Second cousin to G.K. Chesterton, the famous writer and third way distributist. But A.K. was... he left the British Union of Fascists in 37, 38, I think. And he had a fairly distinguished war record. He was a military crossholder. And he came out 45, 46, obviously out of the army after the end of the Second World War. And because at that time, Labour government had swept into power. And this set about busily dismantling the empire. Well, people today talk about the empire like it's an archaic thing, which I suppose it isn't in a way, but it was very much a hot issue, and the British Empire was very, very extensive, even into the early 50s, and it was in 1954. Chesterton was then a member of the Conservative Party, along with a lot of ex-BU, British Union people, and other organisations from the 30s. It was what's called a ginger group. I think we use the name sort of faction or whatever today, but in the 50s they called it a ginger group. I think they had their own stands at Tory Party conferences and things like that. But in 1954, I'm pretty certain of that date, Chesterton formed the League of Empire Loyalists, and he attracted some very heavy guns to it, such as JFC Fuller, Major General Fuller. I think Barry Donville, Admiral Barry Donville, was there. quite a lot of high-ranking generals and admirals, and quite a lot of what we might call the old aristocracy. I mean, there was Rosin de Bonneville. There was Averill Walters, who was Chesterton's secretary for most of the for the old time of the LEL. And so the other, if you looked at an LEL letter heading from those days, you'd be more than impressed. And by 55, 56, they'd actually got 3,000 members, which maybe raises people's eyebrows a bit. And the strategy was that, although there were some calls, we'll come to that, to talk about a new party, Chesterton didn't feel that was the way, and I think perhaps at the time he was right. He felt that the Tory party wasn't a complete loss, which of course we know it is today. And they took on a policy, or a strategy of disruption. They would disrupt high-end Tory party gatherings, and not just Tory party gatherings, left-wing ones, CND, etc. I think at the CND one, they actually, two of their members, I think one of them was Adrian Brooks, actually slept under the speaker's platform during the night. So when the meeting was opened, they leaped out there with all their anti-CND slogans, causing absolute uproar and getting what the LAL was famous for was a hell of a lot of publicity. Another time, the 56, 57, when Joe McEnyatta, the Mau Mau leader, was visiting Britain after Kenyan independence, or leading up to Kenyan independence, and one of the LAL members showered him with a load of, I think it was pigs, sheep's guts, with reference to the Mau Mau connections, where the Mau Mau were, if anybody wants to know what the Mau Mau were, they're a pretty horrific bunch of black savages that based their principles on voodoo and were slaughtering whites all around Kenya at the time. But I mean, that again, pig's guts all over the, sheep's guts all over the Jomo Kenyatta. Couldn't have gone to a nicer chap. So that strategy of high level stunts, because you don't need many people to carry something like that, or two or three people at the most, and they were getting national publicity all the time. So much so, as you said yourself, I don't doubt there probably was a mention in a carry-on film, because they were very much mainstream media, what they were doing.
Well, it sounds, you know, they were the first to really do this, I think. I mean, people copy it today. I think they would call it media jamming a while back was the phrase for it. I guess they say trolling now. Maybe that's evolved from it in a way. But it, basically, just getting the media's attention. I mean, it takes some dedication to spend the night hiding inside the podium where a conference is going to be. So it's, and then leaping out and shouting out LEL slogans. Also, I think it shows that at the time, the Conservative Party must have been far closer to what ethno-nationalism is today than we really think. Because looking at the Wikipedia page for this, they're saying that a lot of the members of this were fascists, they were open fascists, they were members of Oswald Mosley's party, they were racialists, and they were, and it ended up being against non-white immigration. And I mean, throwing sheep's guts over the Kenyan president, that you wouldn't get away with that today, would you?
Unfortunately not. No. In those days, you got to remember, Downing Street didn't have gates on. It wasn't until Thatcher's time. So that if you were presenting a petition or you wanted to demonstrate, you could actually walk up outside Downing Street's front door and make your presence felt. It's another sign, I suppose, of the clampdown on freedom of action and speech. But now if you look at Downing Street, it looks like Fortress Berlin, doesn't it? Going back to the LAL, you're quite right in saying about the Tory party. The Tory party, what we might call the left of centre, the right wing Tories. You had the Monday Club there, you had the January Committee, I think it's called. But you had a heck of a lot of people who were in the peace movements in the late 30s. So the, like the Duke of Bedford, they were very, very active in the Tory party in the early 50s. And of course they were also motivated by the horror of the fact that in 46, Labour swept to power, which stunned the Tory establishment. But as the LEL got bigger, two things happened. One was that the Tory party got wise and started clamping down on their activities. And of course you got a lot of their come lately members started getting cold feet and leaving. And on the other side, Chesterton had attracted some very, very active white nationalists, Colin Jordan, John Bean, John Tyndall, Martin Webster, all names to conjure with in the 60s and 70s, all came from the League of Empire Loyalists. But they were pushing for, well, two things. They were pushing for the LEL to become a party. And secondly, they were pushing for two other things, which was the League of Empire Loyalists to declare that they wouldn't have Jews as members and they wouldn't have non-whites as members, which Chesterton wouldn't see, or rather he didn't feel it was politic.
And by this time, had the British Empire fallen apart? Because it must have been around about this, because it was given away after the war, mm-hmm. Thanks to Churchill. I mean, I think you can blame him for that. So you would think that once the empire had fallen apart, that the name itself wouldn't be that relevant, the League of Empire Loyalists.
True, yeah. It wasn't archaic in the 50s. I mean, the first part of the empire that went was India in 48. Which was the jewel in the crown of the empire. They always got the jewel in the crown. And the Indian independence, which was granted, resulted in an almighty bloodbath. I think there were millions killed as Muslims and Hindus took to the streets butchering each other. And of course, the independence state of Pakistan came out of that. But that was the key that unlocked the dissolution of the empire itself. Once they got away with knowing... I think the lefties, the proto-communists who were running the Labour Party, realised that if they could get rid of India, the rest of the empire could be given away or given independence to smaller states such as Kenya, Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, Nyasaland, lots of other smaller states. Sri Lanka or Ceylon, as it was then known as. And so they all started following like dominoes. But it wasn't actually till the mid to late 60s that we still had not only white dominions, but black dominions. It was 65, 66 when, after Northern Rhodesia had been given away, God knows what it's called now, Banana Land or whatever, Southern Rhodesia actually declared UDI. And the whites held on there, which is another story. So, yeah, the empire was still very relevant, Sven, in the 50s. It died a slow death rather than a quick one.
I remember hearing a debate. I think it was put on by the League of Empire Loyalists. It was a long debate. It was about 2 hours. And it was basically people pointing out why it would be ridiculous to hand over the levers of power to the blacks in these African dependent colonies. And there was two types. There was one liberal type saying all people are equal, and then there was the League of Empire Loyalists representatives who were, you know, sensible and bringing out the facts and figures. I can't remember the name of the debate. I know we've got it somewhere on radio here in Bootlegs. I was just wondering if you might recall the name of it. It was quite, I think it must have been quite famous at the time for it to have been recorded. It was properly professionally recorded.
I don't recall it. I mean, I was still quite young in the 50s. I mean, I didn't really get into white nationalism until the late 60s. But I would think that was one of many. I mean, there was the debate was for ongoing. And as we know, for 99% of all the black and Asian non-white countries that got independence, nearly everyone was followed by a turmoil resulting in a lot of deaths, and then hammered together democracy, which nearly always ended up in a black dictatorship. So the League of Empire Loyalists was quite correct. in the end, we were left with the White Dominions, which we still have tongue-in-cheek today, such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada. We had South Africa, but that's gone now. Falkland Islands and Gibraltar, I suppose. But the league took some pretty nasty knocks in the late 50s. Number one, because the Tory party was clamping down so hard, to the point that they were going to expel from the Tory party if they didn't leave the LEL. So by 58, they were down to about 300 members. They'd lost well over 2,000 members. And at the same time, John Bean and Colin Jordan, followed up by Tindall and Webster, were forming new groups, which became the White Defence League of Colin Jordan and the National Labour Party of John Bean, which were formed in 57, 58. So that really put the sort of final stroke on the LEL. It sort of soldiered on up to 67 with 200 or 300 members. And of course, a very excellent newspaper, which is still going today, our magazine, I should say, Kando. Kando was founded in 54 with the LEL, and it's going well today. It barely misses a monthly issue.
Yeah, I've heard of Kando there. So Colin Jordan, he formed the White, what did you say, the White Nationalist?
The White Defence League.
I've seen the pictures of the shop front with the White Defence League on it. The speeches that he did. And of course, Colin Jordan, again, he was very famous for pulling these media stunts, wasn't he?
He was indeed. Just going back to that, you say, another shop with the White Defence League. That shop is famous in its own right. It was 52 Princedale Road, right in the middle of Notting Hill. And it was actually originally the headquarters of the Imperial Fascist League of Arnold Spencer Leese. By the late 50s, obviously, Spencer Leese had died, but his widow, Maud Leese, gave Princedale Road to Colin Jordan and the WDL, White Defence League. And, also she, out of the funds she'd got, she actually, financed the White Defence League. They had a newspaper, which was quite, Colin Jordan didn't believe in sort of messing about with names. Their newspaper was called Black and White News. And it was he was pretty air-raising, if you read it today, by the way. They did also get embroiled in the 58 race riots in Nottingham.
I think I've seen a copy of one. Steve Frost sent me some old British movement literature, and I think there was a photocopied copy of one of the Black and White News there. I think
it was reprinted, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as what we do with our blogs today, and, you know, showing the news stories, and it was just made out of cut out news clippings and comment on what was going on. It's the same as what we do today, but obviously more technologically advanced in what we're doing today. Just to take you back to that bit that you were saying about when the British Empire fell apart. I mean, every single time it was the same thing. It was just a massive bloodbath afterwards, and then corruption. Yep. And yet we're told today we should be feeling guilty for the British Empire, and maybe there were some bad things that were done with the British Empire. But what it actually did, it brought just the rule of law to these countries. There weren't these massive massacres and bloodbaths with a million people fighting amongst each other, butchering each other, because the white British were there with the forces of law and order to prevent that happening. So, it wasn't all bad. And as soon as the white British people were taken away, you know, we were straight back to the massacres and just today there's a news report from the Congo where the Congolese government is beheading people, wearing female genitalia as medallions, cutting people's penises off and cooking them up and eating them and forcing children to rape mothers and all sorts of really incredibly sick stuff going on that you read about it and you think, well, oh, it was terrible back in the 1800s when they discovered Africa and they had, you know, like butcher shops with human flesh in these butcher shops. It's still going on today and it's the government doing it, the Congolese government. Are doing this in a Sunner report today in the news. None of that happened when it was under white rule.
You've got to remember also that it was the British that ended slavery and patrolled the seas, policed the seas to stop slavery as far as blacks were concerned. It was the Arabs who continued it, and the Arabs and the North Africans that are continuing today with the boat people invasions. But yeah, you're quite right. I mean, once you took away the white infrastructure, then they couldn't. You know, I think Uganda's a brilliant example. Uganda, I mean, it was based on diamonds, coal, it has oil, it has an incredible rich soil. And when the British were there, Uganda again was a jewel in the crown. We gave it independence. You got a comic nutcase like Idi Amin comes into power. And the whole thing is just a farce. But that's what the League of Empires knew was going to happen. Any thinking person would have known that. Anybody who's lived in a black dominated country, would know that these people, you know, they weren't ready for independence. I always think when they talk about the developing world, how long does it take to develop? You know, India's been developing for the last 3,000 years, to my knowledge, and it's still developing.
That's it. They've never developed any form of democracy, any form of justice or law and order. In Africa, they never even developed an alphabet. And yet they've been handed this infrastructure that we've built and told, there you go, you can run a democracy the same as we can. And, you know, they're just incapable of it.
Sorry. This is because egalitarian communism had infiltrated the Labour Party, and of course the generations that came through Oxford and Cambridge in the 30s were well into cultural Marxism, and that generation then took over the civil service. A lot of MPs were of that nuance as well, so that they pushed their egalitarian agenda, and the whole thing of dismantling the empire was a hideous social experiment, perhaps on a par with Lysenko in Soviet Russia, that just couldn't win, just couldn't work. But of course, their warped ideology comes first. If it doesn't work, they chop it and change it until the square peg fits into the round hole, no matter how many people's lives it costs.
The status and prestige that we used to have with that empire. I mean, we used to have Empire Day and children used to be taught about it. We used to be yeah. proud of our country and interested in learning about these other countries, these other peoples, and how we had helped their lives, how we taught them to read, how we built railway lines, hospitals, taught them how to read and write, built universities, you know, tried to civilize them. You know, yeah. We were told to be proud of that. And now it's all gone, and we're just told we should be feeling guilty.
I remember as a 8-9-year-old child, that would have been 57, 58, sitting in my classroom and staring at a map of the world. And there was so much of it was red, from Egypt all the way down to South Africa. It said that you could walk from Cairo to Cape Town and actually never leave the British Empire. You know, the sun never set, mainly because as the sun rose on one part of the empire, it set on another. But I remember, and I wasn't alone, immense feelings of pride in being British. To the point that, you know, in that days I was quite a religious young thing, actually thanking God in my prayers for making me British. You know, can you imagine? And that wasn't abnormal. That was what a lot of young people felt.
I can imagine that. That's exactly how it was. So then the League of Empire Loyalists realised that you know, they weren't going to be able to stop us losing the empire. And I guess members decided that it was time to sort of turn their sights on what was happening back home, and that all these savages from the former empire were then going to start invading Britain, and we needed to defend Britain. So I guess that also must have played into this idea of we need to have a party, and we need to stop non-whites and Jews. And then you ended up with these two other groups forming. So what happened to these two other groups? Because they kind of lasted that long.
Sorry to interrupt. The League of Empire Loyalists, just a quick overview, it was a product of its time, which, as you've said quite rightly, which was the dissolution of the British Empire, bad thing that it was. But of course, by the early 60s, the turn of the decade from the 50s to 60s, that had, and we were suffering massive coloured immigration into Britain, that stance of the LEL was, you know, it was over and done with. And I think Chesterton knew that as well. It sort of got down to just a hardcore of people. And of course, until 67, he brought them into the NF. But to answer your question as to the White Defence League of Colin Jordan, and I believe John Tyndall was White Defence League, and the National Labour Party of John Bean, and Martin Webster and others. First of all, the National Labour Party, they stood in an election in Kensington. I think they got quite a good vote. They also popularised the term Keep Britain White, which I believe you'd probably get 6 months for these days. But the Labour Party proper took court action against the National Labour Party and forced them to change the name, and they became the British National Party. The first British National Party. And during the course of time, the White Defence League wound itself up and merged with the British National Party. So by about 64, 65, you had a fairly unified movement there. 62, 63, with Colin Jordan, John Bean, Tyndall Webster and others forming and getting quite a big organisation together, really. Andrew Fountain, an Norfolk landowner, and that suffered a number of splits itself. But that's what happened. The LEL turned, the Ginger Group stunt organisations faded away, and the straightforward mass political parties started then.
And that was a that became the British National Party. But that didn't. That isn't where John Tyndall's BNP started, is it? Because the National Front suddenly came in from somewhere. Did the British National Party grow into the National Front? Did it merge with Chesterton to become the National Front? Is that what happened?
It did. It did suffer some splits. The Colin Jordan, who put his National Socialism very much to the fore, following Rockwell's doctrine of showing a swastika, became more and more openly National Socialist. And of course, this, I wouldn't say John Bean disagreed with the principle of it, but he certainly disagreed with the flying of a swastika. So the BNP itself suffered a major split when the National Socialist Movement was formed in 62. The BNP then continued on its way to become part of the National Front in 67. The National Socialist Movement suffered further splits with the Tyndall and Jordan falling out and the Greater Britain Movement being formed in 65. It was all parcelled up and wrapped up when they all came together in 67, apart from Colin Jordan, of course, who was kept out of it. Much to my, you know, that was a big mistake on the NF's part to keep Jordan out.
Yeah, we went into that last week, I think, didn't we?
Yeah.
We said that John Tyndall was allowed to join the National Front after a probational period of a year, but Colin Jordan wasn't allowed to, which really sort of split the movement, because Colin Jordan then went on to form British Movement, and then you had National Front, and really those two should have been together.
Yeah, Jordan was all for it, and British Movement would have never existed, because Jordan would have been active in the National Front. It's a what if situation. What would have happened from then? But when I joined, I mean, it was very much a hot potato, and we were all shaking our heads, and there was a lot of pressure on Chesterton, Fountain, and others, and John Bean to allow CJ in. But as you say, it is an area we have covered before.
And if they'd had him in charge of like media relations or propaganda, then it would have been the NF that were doing these you know, pulling off these media stunts and getting all the publicity.
Yeah. Well, they did pull off quite a lot of media stunts. I mean, the LEL media stunts lived on in the National Front in the early days, 68, 69, 70. I think Roy Attersley was flower-bombed. Was it Roy Attersley? No, it was Dennis Ealy was flower bombed by National Front women on an anti-paedophile demonstration, and that made front page news. There was another time when Martin Webster took about 40 National Front into a film. The film was How I Won the War, which was a sickening thing with pacifists such as Spike Milligan and the disreputable John Lennon. and company, basically making fun of the British Empire, making fun of everything the British Army and the British Armed Forces stood for, and belittling pacifism. Belittling the Empire and pushing pacifism. The film was pushed like hell by the communists, you know, must-see film. But the National Front disrupted it very well on more than one occasion. But on that particular occasion, as Webster disrupted it as he was disrupting it with a microphone, decrying the film as anti-British and anti-British armed forces. Members then stamped on stink bombs and actually completely closed the cinema down. Nobody was arrested on that particular time. But the next day, you close a major cinema down in Leicester Square. It was Leicester Square Odeon. And you're going to hit national headlines, which they did, we did. And that was a National Front demonstration, very much in the mould of the LAL.
Nice one. And you were saying that there was another instance with this Kenyatta as well and Martin Webster?
Yes, it just came to mind when we were talking about the sheep's cuts. About 2 years before that, in the Greater Britain movement, before Martin came over to the National Front, Kenyatta was on another visit. He was then president of an independent Kenya, which was fast reverting to cannibalism and tribalism. And Martin didn't pull his punches. He just went straight up and thumped the guy, knocked him to the floor, restrained by bodyguards and arrested. Martin got about 3-6 months for that. But again, I mean, you got world headlines, you know, you're knocking a president of a country, in brackets, onto the floor. It's going to get you some publicity. Going back to my old adage that bearing some very, very minor things in mind, there is absolutely no substitute for publicity, absolutely not. And you can get it with just a few people.
Well, just with one man, if they, you know, if they got the courage to go up to a guy and just land one on him. That's amazing stuff, Eddie. I'm really glad we've got you on here to talk about it. I hadn't heard about half of those things before. So hopefully you'll come back and tell us some more next Monday with some more of.
I'll be very pleased. Yeah, I'd like to cover the formation of the World Union of National Socialists in 1962. And that should be quite interesting for listeners.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that next Monday. Thank you very much for coming on, Eddie. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Florian Geyer. God bless and hail victory.